If you've missed a show, the full audio library is at RadioMD.com. And now back to you, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
And this is Dr. Mike. If you have anything to do that is more important than this, I can't believe it. Because coming at the bottom of the hour, Dr. Justin Zivin, I think he deserves a Nobel Prize for his work on stroke. He's going to tell us the past and the future of stroke care. He's really the one who got time lost, his brain lost, done, because he's the one who got TPA, despite the big drug company and even NIH opposing its being used for this. He got it. It's now standard of care. He's going to tell us what the future is. But right now, right this minute, is my favorite segment of the show, You, the Owner's Manual Show, every week. It's Gary Ginsberg, What's Toxic and What's Not. Tell me about algal blooms and artificial wetlands, Gary.
It would be my honor, Mike. Thanks for having me back on. Yes, you know, if you're out in Salinas County, which is the lettuce bowl of the country, and you are putting lots of nitrogen and phosphorus into the ground, where on earth do you think that all that fertilizer is going? You know, maybe 10 or 15% goes into your crop, and the rest of it is going to get down into the water table, get run off by storms, and end up in maybe Monterey Bay, of all places, and create algal growth, kill fish, affect swimmers, look real ugly.
So those algal blooms you told us were really toxic. They're what caused Toledo to shut down its public water supply for a number of days, because it has really toxins in it that are neurotoxins. They kill your nerve cells.
Yeah, microcystin is one of the several that we've identified so far that we know how to monitor for, measure. But you do not want to be swimming in a body of water that's looking blue-green, certainly. So the US EPA is trying to do is get a hold on what we call non-point source pollution, which is coming from runoff from farms. And all this fertilizer that does create these algal blooms, whether it's affecting your water quality in Cleveland or Toledo, or whether it's affecting the environment over in Monterey Bay. And so what they're coming up with, this is a novel approach, this is what I call what's not toxic, this is innovative, is if you've got, say, 100 or 200 acre farm, you put in a 3-acre wetland that is at the bottom, at the lowest point, at the ditch point of the farm where all the nutrients, all the pesticides are going, and that is where the storms are going to drain your farm into. And you, even though it's artificially constructed and even though you have to water it to keep it alive, you've got weeds, you've got cattails, you've got things, maybe frogs in there, maybe even a turtle if you're lucky, and you are going to be detoxifying and using up and sucking all the excess nutrient before it gets out into the greater environment and gets to contaminate the local bay and lead to an algal bloom. So this may be, if this works, and I think this is going to catch on, to dedicate parts of large acreage into farmland into artificial wetland. And we know that wetlands are a great sponge, and we know that that's why, you know,
why won't algal blooms take over the wetland?
No, because the wetland is already known to have algae growing, and they're not harmed by algae. A wetland is saying the more algae, the better. It doesn't matter if we get boggy. It doesn't matter if we overgrow. That's all part of the sponge effect of a wetland. And so nobody's going to try to swim in a wetland. Nobody's going to try to eat the fish out of a wetland. you shouldn't be developing a wetland either. That's why it's getting so difficult now with building permits to disrupt a wetland, because we are learning how important they are to the greater ecology and to the greater detoxification of the environment for whatever we're putting into the environment. They are great sponges and great detoxifiers. So
it's really the sponge effect, and it's a sponge effect, and then protecting that wetland for be used for anything other than the sponge effect.
And even putting in extra wetlands where they don't exist right now. Yes, absolutely.
The allergy gender gap. Why are allergies greater in women?
Right. Well, I don't know if you've noticed this, but the literature is replete with studies that show that women do get more autoimmune reactions, greater anaphylactic shock reactions, greater amount of allergy, dermatitis, eczema, and all of these conditions may be related to this new finding that the National Institute of Health is putting out in some new research that shows that estrogen stimulates the increased production of a certain enzyme, nitric oxidase, and nitric oxidase causes vasodilation. So estrogen leads to increased vasodilation when it comes to an immune reaction. What does vasodilation do? It makes your blood vessels more leaky. It allows inflammatory cells into tissues, which is a good thing if you've got dead cells to clean out, but it's not such a good thing when it comes to an expanding inflammatory reaction. So women will tend to have, because of estrogen, greater inflammatory reactions, greater tissue damage, greater release of histamine because of, say, an IgE type reaction and an allergy type reaction. So what do we do about that? Well, that's another story, but because of this kind of a finding from the National Institute of Health, this may give us a handle on a way to cut down on anaphylactic reactions by inhibiting the production of nitric oxidase and expansion of blood vessels. Vasodilation leads to more inflammation.
Well, you know where nitric oxide is important, though. It's all your sexual habits, as well as it dilates blood vessels in the heart when you need it to exercise, etc. So it's going to have to be really targeted to those areas where you're allergic, such as specific areas in the lung.
Right. Well, what we do right now to combat anaphylaxis is dilate the respiratory tree. So, we'll have to continue giving people EpiPens, but this may be another approach, is inhibiting nitric oxide formation as well as vasodilating, just for those moments when you are in that kind of distress.
What's toxic about my pizza, Gary?
Your pizza box. Yes, we have banned in this country additives like perchlorate, which is an anti-static chemical in pizza boxes, as well as the perfluoro compounds, which are anti-stain, anti-stick chemicals. So you know when you get Chinese
those are in my pizza box now?
Well, they could be, yes. Because we banned it in this country if you're making a domestic pizza box. But if we are getting paper products imported from overseas, they are still allowed to use it overseas. And we may not be so good at checking at the border. So there are now lawsuits directed towards the FDA by some activist groups like NRDC, saying you've got to do a better job at keeping out of this country perfluoro-embedded takeout containers and pizza boxes from overseas that contain these kinds of chemicals, because they will get, these chemicals will migrate out of the cardboard and get into the food. So, you know,
do cause big league disease.
Well, they cause disruption of endocrine systems and organ systems like the liver. And so my rule of thumb is I don't want to eat takeout more than, say, once a week, because I just don't trust takeout containers, especially hot food in things like a plastic Tupperware, for soup or a pizza box, because the food will get some degree of contamination.
We'll talk more with Gary Ginsberg next week on You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. We're live again next week, and Gary is my favorite segment. Coming up, what's new about stroke?